Hey, boys and girls, welcome to the NeoWinCast News Edition, brought to you by NeoWin.net, for April 20th, 2007. I'm your host, Chris Vendemio, BangBang023 on the forums, and joining me as always, my buddy from across the Atlantic, Rob Wright. We know him as Rob. How's it going, man?
Things are okay, not too bad, but I just found out that my house was broken into yesterday, so I'm having to deal with police and stuff, which isn't very nice, but not to worry.
Any of you over in the UK, if you love Rob at all, you'll find out who did this and kick their ass for both of us, okay? I think that's excellent. Fair. Today, guys, we're going to talk about a myriad of stories. We're going to talk about Windows XP. We're going to talk about Sony DVD DRM disasters. You know, Sony in the news again. And tons of news about Apple. But we're actually going to start off with XP. And the first half of this story is a story that we actually did last week, but then at the last minute we decided it didn't contribute to the show. So Rob decided to cut it out of the show, and obviously I agreed. Well, it's back again this week, so we can rediscuss it. Rob, firstly, this time last week, Microsoft announced that they're going to be phasing out Windows XP from OEMs. You know, OEMs are companies like HP, Dell, Compaq, all these companies that sell Windows preloaded on their machines. Microsoft said by January 2008, XP is no longer going to be available to these companies. They're going to have to simply put Vista out there. And, you know, it seemed like a pretty common sense maneuver. It's going to happen eventually. Vista is a new baby. They really want to promote Vista as hard as they can. And, well, XP is generally competing with it right now. However, news broke yesterday that while for a while Dell had almost every system available on their website available only as a Vista system, they're actually going to be bringing back XP as an option on some of their home systems. So it seems as though people have been clamoring a bit for XP to come back. You know, Rob, this is a pretty big move. In the light of everything, when Microsoft keeps telling us that Vista is better, here comes Dell saying, well, we listen to our customers, and not everyone thinks Vista is better. A lot of them want XP back. With this new information from Dell as far as reinstating XP's presence on their home systems, do you think that maybe Microsoft may be ending OEM support for XP a bit too prematurely to satisfy the customer? Not for best business practices, but to satisfy the customers out there.
It's an interesting story because Dell have recently jumped on this sort of, you know, the blogging bandwagon and all this user collaboration and the like. And so they've decided to launch this service where people can say what they really want and give feedback to Dell. And so far it's been quite successful now. We've seen, you know, laptops with Linux preloaded and other such developments like that. And they've all come about from this one system. So now we're seeing that also because of that, XP is going to be used on a lot of other systems. I think it's a great move by Dell because it's almost like, you know, XP is the kind of the mature and the trusted uncle of everybody, you know, the kind of wise old uncle that everyone knows and loves. And then Vista's this kind of like, you know, your mum's new boyfriend or something, and you're not quite sure, he's a bit shifty, and, you know, and this is what people seem to be thinking of the operating system. It's new, it's not tried and tested at all. And I think people are, you know, are voting with their feet and saying, actually, no, I want to stick with what I know has worked and what's, you know, worked well for the last, well, you know, the last 6 years. So I can't imagine that Microsoft are very happy about it, because obviously they've been putting just billions into this research and development for something that they consider the most amazing operating system they've ever made. And I agree, I think it's wonderful. But is it that they've been premature in suggesting that they ought not to sell the licenses for it? Well, if the people are anything to go by, then yes, they're right. But then you've got to question whether it's more the fact that they haven't experienced Vista rather than they dislike it. I mean, which do you think it is? Do you think it's that they are just being scared to try new things, or do you think they've tried it and realized that it's not good for them?
I actually think it's a combination of both. First of all, I think a lot of people are scared to move to something different. Vista does reorganize a lot of things. Does with the user account control system in place that prompts you to verify the actions of almost everything your PC does, it may scare off some new users. You know, maybe it bothers them, maybe they're just not... they feel uncomfortable with all these warning messages, I'm really not sure. But on top of that, as we've stated week in and week out, driver support, hardware support is still very limited for Vista. That's where a lot of people are running into issues. Some odd off-market sound cards, not even off-market, just non-creative sound cards. Well, even the creative sound cards aren't working. But basically, any sound card in the freaking market right now isn't working 100%. And that's definitely going to turn a lot of people off, especially as Microsoft pushes towards trying to get the PC into the living room. One of the key things from the multimedia experience is sound, and if our sound cards aren't working 100% correctly, well, then there's going to be a big issue there. But also, too, like you said, XP is trusted. We had it for, what, 5 years, XP? And especially after Service Pack 2, as I've said before, it became probably the best operating system Microsoft ever put out. It was stable, reliable. I'm sure there were some security issues, but people found third-party software, a lot of it free, that shore up their system pretty quickly. So it's one of those cases where people look at things and say, well, if it ain't broken, why fix it? So, I don't know. It's hard. Looking at this, looking at Dell's bringing it back now, while I'm happy to see a company doing what the customer wants, they have to realize XP's life is coming to an end very, very quickly, and putting out new systems with an old operating system on it is going to cause them support issues in the future. You know, what happens when Microsoft stops supporting XP? There's no more patches for it. However, a Dell customer has a warranty that covers their entire PC. You know, they're going to run into these support issues, and I'm not sure business-wise it was the greatest move to bring it back, but for the customers, you know, this is great for the customers. You're giving the customers exactly what they want. They wanted Linux, Dell gave them Linux. They wanted XP, Dell's bringing back XP. You know, where can you go wrong? I just don't see how this is going to end, though. Do you have any idea of how long they're going to have XP? How long do you think, I should say, should these OEMs hang on to XP before saying, enough is enough, you have to move to Vista now?
Ultimately, there's a finite time in that they can't get new licenses for it come 2008. So there's a maximum of sort of half a year of them doing this. I think they should start giving it up now, though, because as with these new systems, they've got brand new hardware in them, and for the most part, that hardware is going to work fine with Vista. And for that reason, I think it's important that they do embrace the new operating system and all the security issues, you know, features, I should say. That's probably a Freudian slip there, calling security issues in Vista. But no, I think they should embrace the technology, because there's a lot of new things in Vista that are really going to benefit the home consumer and, you know, some of the multimedia professionals, for example. But when it comes to things like game support, it's not as bad as it was during the beta or whatever, but there's still a few issues with some games, and certainly with graphics drivers. Again, we've stated time and time again, this isn't Microsoft's fault, but it's just the way it is. So I can see why Dell have done this, but I do agree with you, Chris, that it's not the best business sense, because if they're having to support two operating systems, and then I guess also if they're going to have to support Linux with it as well, then that's a significant amount of support costs for something they really haven't been doing up to this point. And I guess they have to weigh up whether they think it's right because of the benefits for the consumer, or whether actually it's going to end up costing them more in the long run. My sort of naive advice, not running Dell, but just in terms of what's going to be better for consumers in the long run, is to actually start forcing them to use Vista. It may sound a bit unfortunate, but for those who want to use XP, well, they already can, because they've got computers. They're not being forced to buy new ones. But I think if you're buying a new computer, then there's really no reason to stay with XP. That's my honest opinion.
Yeah, Rob, you actually just made a point I was going to say next. But the fact is, when you're buying these new PCs, almost every PC on the market, even the ones you're getting for like $400 from retailers, come with some pretty decent hardware in them. Usually RAM may be a little lacking, so you may have to add a little bit more RAM. But otherwise, all these machines are more than capable of running Vista at a pretty decent pace. You know, I can see XP being important for users with an old machine. For instance, my father has a AMD Athlon 1800 plus. You know, in that case, yeah, XP is definitely better for him because it can handle the slower hardware better than Vista can. However, if you're buying a new machine, you know, you're getting one of these low-cost machines that have an Intel Core 2 Duo in them, do you really need XP? Are you just being finicky, or I want to say rebellious, but this would be a stupid thing to be rebellious over. The fact is, Vista is here, and if you want to stick with the Windows operating environment, you're going to have to go with Vista. Otherwise, you know, I'm not saying you have to give into the Microsoft way. If you don't like Vista, there are other alternatives out there for people. You can try the migration over to Apple and know that on any of the current machines, you can dual boot XP, so you can have the familiarity. Every week I try to say this word and I can't say it. You know what I'm saying?
Every week, Chris.
you can have that sameness, that's what I'm going to say. And then you can also experiment with OS X, or you can be one of the brave few and try Linux. But the fact is, clamoring for XP and sticking with something that's starting to show its age a bit compared to its newer son, brother, whatever you want to call it, I don't know, it just seems picky on the consumer's part, and a poor decision on Dell's part as in terms of business decisions go, but kudos to them for listening to the customer. It may hurt them in the long run, but they gave the customer what they want. That's what any good business does. Speaking of good businesses, though, every good business has to have an evil, bad business counterpart out there in the world. And as all too often has been in recent weeks, that brings us to Sony. Sony recently released a few DVDs with newer software copy protection on them, particularly on their movies Stranger Than Fiction and The Holiday. Well, both these movies aren't playing in many DVD players, including Sony DVD players. This one gentleman has a Sony DVP-CX995V. We actually sell this where I work. It's a 400-disc DVD changer. It can catalog your whole library and such. And, well, it wouldn't play on his player. A lot of people, even on Neowin, have said they've rented the movies, and the movies won't play on anything. One poster said it only played on his 24-inch Mac. Another person said he had to go through three or something DVDs. I can't find that exact post at the moment. But the fact is, you know, they put out this that won't play. And my question to you is, Rob, we've seen this time and time again. Sony wants to protect their copyrights. It's very obvious at this point. I mean, they should just put a big label on the front saying, if you steal this, we're going to kill you. Because it gets to the point where they're stopping users from doing what they want as far as watching the movies go. It's not even like copying it. People just want to watch the movie and they can't do it. When are people going to draw the line and say, Sony, you got to cut, and part of my language, you got to cut the crap. We're just going to stop buying your products, because this isn't the first DRM issue we've had from Sony. We had a few, I think it's only been a few months back, maybe up to a year at this point, where they had the rootkit on many of their audio CDs that was secretly infecting systems, and, well, you know, people weren't too happy about it. So where's the line drawn? Obviously, people are still buying Sony CDs now, and while the uproar has been decent over this, it hasn't been all that astounding to the point where people are saying, I said we had to boycott Sony. Give Sony some credit, though. They did admit the problem, finally, and said that if you can contact them, and they'll send you out a new disc with corrected software on it and all. But where's the line, Rob? When does the people, as one group, stand up and say, that's it, enough is enough, get your act together, or we're just going to give our business to someone else? Where's the line?
It's ridiculous. I was reading this story, and I couldn't believe that Sony, with all the problems they've had recently about digital rights management, how can they possibly do something so stupid? It's like, when you're that big, okay, software that you write that is going out to that many customers, it has to go through so, well, okay, I'll rephrase that. It should go through so much in terms of testing to make sure that it works with the software and the hardware that's out there. How can you legitimately release a disc with digital rights management software on it that doesn't work with your own DVD players? This is like, it's not even that it doesn't work with other manufacturers' DVD players. You're basically just cutting off half of your market because you have you're slightly overzealous when it comes to your digital rights management. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any business sense. It doesn't make any sense for the consumer. I don't understand how it could have come about, because, I mean, judging by the way that businesses work, there must be one guy that is in charge of the digital rights management division, let's say. Let's just, for argument's sake, say there's a division. There must be one guy who is a manager of that and who oversees what's going on. And I don't understand why he still has a job if you're releasing software on DVDs that doesn't play. I apologize if I sound like I'm not understanding what's going on, but it's one of those stories that's almost difficult to fathom whether it's actually just an April Fool's joke that's somehow very late. I don't understand it, Chris. I really don't understand it. This isn't like stopping people copying. This is stopping people playing it. What's that all about?
Yeah, and to make the point even worse, this Sony, the model that I read, the DVP-CX995, it's not an old DVD player model. They're actually still selling it on the market. It did come out in late 2005, so it's a little over a year old at this point. However, it's still their current model as far as large storage DVD changers go. I guess that's the proper term for it. So, I mean, it's not even an old player that won't play. It's a new player from them that won't play their movies. Where, I just don't understand how people can continually accept this kind of, I want to say, punishment from Sony for being legal purchases. All the people affected by this are the people who plunk down the money to either rent or buy the movie, give Sony their money, and in turn, they had nothing but a hassle. Basically, the one gentleman wrote as a description, both titles, Stranger Than Fiction and The Holiday, both load up to the splash title screen and then load no further. Then after about 60 seconds, the player turns itself off. Well, that's an intriguing feature. You know, I want to know what Sony's thinking, and it comes to a point where, do they even care about public perception anymore? When you look at Sony, rough comparison, and some Sony fans are probably not going to like me for it, But it's almost like looking at the RIAA in some aspects, in the fact that they will do anything and everything to do what they feel is right in protecting their copyright, and they don't care who they step on, no matter how many customers get upset over it. And as a business, can you really operate for too long of a period with an ideology like that, where you can just step on your customers' toes time and time again? It concerns me, to say the least. They're pushing Blu-ray right now, and is the same going to happen with Blu-ray? Are they going to change something in the future where current Blu-ray players can't play future discs? You know, where's the trust factor? We keep laying on Sony week after week. And some people say, well, maybe the media itself, I guess we're part of the media now, picks on Sony. You know, they find every little morsel of bad information about the company and uses it to strike against Sony. Well, when you do something stupid like this, you're going to have at least the entire internet, probably a few TV stations too, on your back saying, what the hell is up, guys? You can't treat your consumers like outright criminals to the point where they can't even use what they paid for. Now, this can be a whole discussion going into DRM, this can be, you know, Windows Genuine Advantage, all this. But the fact of the matter is, if you're going to DRM your products, fine, but you have to make sure they work. If they don't work for legal purchases, for the simple basic feature of watching the movie, then there's just something wrong. And that manager, if there is a division, that manager should not be fired. The whole division should be completely, like, kicked in the balls and then fired. Because no one deserves this kind of punishment after paying upwards of $20 for a movie. Feels good to get all angry and riled up, Rob.
It really does, but I don't understand it. You know, there's just certain things that don't make any sense here. It's what I don't get is how you can run a company where you're completely ignoring customers and their perception. It's like, you know, and if you took any classes in business, like when you were about sort of 5 years old, even, you know, just general common sense of reading the news, you understand that, you know, this whole concept of the customer is always right, that's drummed into you from a very early age. You know, even if you don't work in retail, that's something which is kind of like a common thing that people know, and Sony just haven't seemed to pick that one up yet. You know, they're treating... I'm going to say, yeah, you're treating us like criminals, Sony, when we're not even trying to pirate your stuff at all. I just want to watch it, and I'm being forced to, I don't know, shell out for one particular type of DVD player or to upgrade the firmware of my player. It's just absolutely ridiculous. Can we move on, Chris? Because I'm just going to get me annoyed, and then I'm going to sound like an idiot for the rest of the podcast.
All right, we'll move on to... It's probably the hottest, most talked-about piece of technology coming down the pipeline. And sure enough, it has an Apple name on it. It's the iPhone. It's the partnership between Apple and Singular, or the new AT&T Wireless, as they want you to say. And it's going to be, you know, they're expecting to sell 10 million of these phones. The iPhone itself is a fully touchscreen phone. The screen goes almost from the complete top to the complete bottom of the face. There's going to be two versions, one that's 4 gigabytes, one that's 8 gigabytes. So you can store your iTunes music on the iPhone. You can listen to music. You know, it's one of these really cool technological pieces out there. I can't even spend the time getting to every feature of this because I'll be here for 3 days doing it. Very cool piece of technology. However, one of the concerns with the iPhone has been the price point. The 4 gigabyte model with a 2-year deal from AT&T is going to cost $500. The 8 gigabyte model with a 2-year agreement is going to cost $600. Well, it seems as though after some market research that Apple is now seriously considering a rebate on the iPhones. You know, that's common with almost every phone. Every phone has a mail-in rebate of sorts whenever you get a new contract with the company. Right now, there's no hard information regarding how much the rebate would be, if there's actually going to be a rebate for sure, but Apple Insider is reporting they're looking at a rebate between $50 to $150 US. They're going to guess the low $50 would be something for the 4 gigabytes, $150 would be for the 8 gigabytes, making the phones a little more affordable for the average user. You know, Rob, do you really think that the rebate is needed? Do you look at this and say, well, there's no way in hell I'm paying $600 for a new phone, and that's when I'm getting a 2-year deal from AT&T. Do you think that for them to reach this very optimistic goal of 10 million units sold, they really have to put these rebates on? And what cost, I guess in US dollars, unfortunately, it's going to be a little conversion in your head, how big of a rebate should Apple include with the iPhone?
Rebates are a strange one. I think this is when our sort of transatlantic differences come into play, really. Because rebates aren't something you see a huge amount in the UK. You know, if I'm looking on US websites or whatever and I see products on offer and it says, you know, with a mail-in rebate. Mail-in rebates is something that we really don't have over here. It's very uncommon to see a mail-in rebate. So, I don't know, it just seems a bit bizarre. But then I realise this is it's a cultural issue because of the way, you know, the US is a lot bigger than the UK, and to centralise discounts and all the rest of it, I understand the importance of rebates and stuff. It's just something very bizarre, and I don't think you'd see it in the UK. But the original point about the phone, well, just offer it at the price you actually want to sell it for rather than sort of forcing people to mail stuff in. And it just almost seems like rebate or no rebate, it's aimed at a very particular niche market of those which have a high level of disposable income. Therefore, something, you know, rebates which are generally aimed at the kind of the normal, the mass market, this isn't a mass market product. And I don't know where they're getting this figure of 10 million units, because I really don't see that they can really shift that many. I mean, it just seems extreme. I don't know if that's internationally. I don't know if that's in the... It's got to be internationally, because there's no way that you could shell out 10 million units in the US. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But I'm yet to see which network it's going to be offered for in the UK. Maybe that they've made that announcement, but I haven't actually read it. Internationally, sure, if they want to, you know, get that many. But I just think rebates, it seems more like a marketing thing to me than actually a decent price difference for consumers. It's just one of the, just offer it for a price you want to sell it for. Don't mess around with having to do all these things. And just it's an expensive premium product, so market it as an expensive premium product and just stop coming up with all this marketing bullshit, because it's just not the way it works, you know?
I want to thank Rob for cursing yet again. Thank you, Rob. But yeah, I do agree. One thing that really, I guess, comes to my mind, the question I keep asking is, did maybe Apple overshoot their goal a bit as far as functionality price ratio? Because while the device is very functional, they seem to want to aim it at middle America, mainstream America, and yet they put a very upper class price on. It's a cell phone, let's face it. That's all it is. It's a cell phone. So do you think that maybe, well, obviously we both seem to agree that the 10 million units sold, if it's, especially if it's only in the U.S., is very, very optimistic, to put it nicely. Do you think that maybe they went too far as features went, wound up making the phone too expensive to manufacture, and in the end, too expensive to sell, and people are just not going to bite onto it as much as they and AT&T would like?
I think there's a point there, absolutely. I think, more than anything, this has been a great way of stirring up publicity for Apple, and it's been an amazing proof of concept phone. Now, we can only theorise what it's going to be like when it's actually out there on the market. I can only suggest, based on what I think, that this isn't going to do nearly as well as Apple suspects. But then I think it's an important, because it's almost like a test for the industry and for the market. This is a very, you know, we've seen premium phones for quite some time. We've got stuff like the BlackBerry, for example, which has, you know, premium features like pushed email and all the rest of it, and that's sold at a premium price. It's sold for business customers, and it's targeting a specific market, and that's done extremely well, and that has an amazing market share of that niche of the market, you know, that segment. I think what Apple have done when they've made the iPhone, they've really kind of dangled it in front of people's faces and said, you know, look what's possible, and it's an incredible feat of engineering. But I just think if they could make with the iPod, you've got various classifications of iPod, and it's almost like, for example, not everyone is going to want this, what they call visual voicemail, I think, which is this voicemail that you can kind of pick and choose and look there, that demands a lot on the network operator, actually. So that's why there's been a huge amount of collaboration with AT&T, Singular, whoever it is. But not everyone is going to want to use all the features. And I just wonder whether the core product, which is this amazingly high-resolution screen and the iPod functionality, whether they could actually make a slightly more affordable version that doesn't have all the bells and whistles like, I don't know, the maps, and for example, but actually just has this amazing phone that is an amazing phone which happens to have iPod functionality, as opposed to being an amazing phone that's actually just this huge Mac in a tiny, tiny enclosure. I think there's places for both on the market, but I think it's more a test of the market than actually a product that it's really ready for at the price we're offering it for. I'm just really going to be interested to see who goes for this. They've got to have some kind of industry analysis going on this to see what happens, because if it goes well, it's going to shake the market up like we haven't seen forever. I mean, Apple did it with the PC, and, you know, they're doing it with the phone. That's the plan. Whether or not it'll happen, we've yet to see. Remind me, which month is it that they actually go live with this in the States?
I believe it's June, though I've been looking for that information, and I must be an idiot today because I can't find it. But actually, one thing I want to mention, you brought up the BlackBerry, and that actually brings the discussion to another competitor, we'll say, for the BlackBerry, and that's the whole idea of Windows smartphones and Windows Pocket PCs. I just recently, last month, extended with a 2-year deal with AT&T, and for $250, I got a Samsung Blackjack after mail-in rebate. That's going to be $150 for that phone. It's a beautiful phone, QWERTY keyboard, and all the bells and whistles, and running Windows Smartphone Edition. And honestly, when I look at the fact that I had to plunk down $250 at the register, I felt very uncomfortable spending that much money on a cell phone. I can't possibly imagine spending double that or even more for something from Apple while having to sign a 2-year deal. I mean, I think the rebates, if there's no rebate, their numbers are going to be missed greatly because people simply can't afford it. I mean, everyone wants the latest, greatest technology, yes, but it comes to a point where people need food more than they need a cell phone. And I don't know too many people who can afford a $600 cell phone just like that. And I snap my finger. I don't know if people can hear it, but there it goes.
I got it.
So I think Apple really needs to sit down and say, do we want to sacrifice some profitability for the sake of getting more units out there? Because this is their first real venture into the cell phone market. I mean, obviously they had the phone with Motorola that had the iTunes software on it, but it was kind of bootleg, didn't do all that much as far as iTunes functionality goes. So this is the first venture out there into the cell phone market. And they're not only making their software, which Microsoft only does, they're also making their hardware. So they need to get it right the first time, and they really need to get the industry excited about this. And yeah, you have all the features, you have the beautiful design of the cell phone, and you have all the hype in the world. But in the end, if people can't afford it, well, look at the PlayStation 3. It's not selling that well because a lot of people can't afford it. They have to look at these industry lessons, I guess, and say, well, okay, maybe we have to bite the bullet, lose some money, and get these phones into more people's hands. So that way we can say, look, it's a success. Here comes iPhone version 2. It's going to be 10 times even better. Spend more money on it, ladies and gentlemen. without these rebates, I don't even see them reaching 1 million units in 2 years' time. I really don't. It's not what people can afford. It's not, for most people, a cell phone, while it's a great commodity, it's not a necessity. And they need to realize that very quickly, because otherwise they're going to be shooting themselves in the foot. I want to see this phone succeed. I want to see innovation, because this is probably some of the best innovation we've seen from any company other than the popular cell phone manufacturer, HTC. So, you know, I want to see this innovation in the market. I want to see someone maybe edge Microsoft a little bit more into improving their software, because while I love their software, it could be better. And what company to nudge them along other than their arch rival, Apple? And especially later this year, there's still rumors about the Google phone coming. Who knows what the hell that's going to be about. So if that's the case, you know, Apple really needs to get this. This is their time to take the market, and they need to do it right the first time. They need to cut that price down. You know, for the 4-gigabyte model, you should be paying about $300, not $500. Obviously, they're not going to lower it that much, but they got to get it at least a little closer. I'd say take $100 off that $500 price tag. And then people will start saying, yeah, maybe it's for me. On top of that, I don't believe it has it, but I'd love to see some kind of digital media expansion as far as micro SD slots, maybe even a mini SD slot so you can get higher capacity, because 4 gigabytes of music isn't all that much, especially for the cost. It'll be interesting to follow. I say that a lot, but this is probably one of the hottest stories on the internet right now, besides all the DRM discussion going. So it's definitely something people should follow. And we're actually going to stick with Apple for our last story. As we reported last week, Apple has just made a deal with EMI Group, where they're going to release a large portion of EMI's library without digital rights management software, meaning you can take the tracks, you can put them on your Microsoft Zune if you want, if it supports the format, I'm not even sure. You can copy it over to a Linux PC, play it on Linux. You can do all these fun things that you couldn't do beforehand because of the DRM software that's included on most current tracks in the iTunes library. However, as happy as we were about it, there are a few people out there who aren't too happy, namely Universal Music Group, Sony BMG Music Entertainment, and Warner Music Group. Why aren't these guys happy? Well, they all have to renew their contracts with Apple soon, as far as having their library music on the iTunes Music Store. Most of these guys, we're going to call them what they are, the RIAA, because that's what they basically is here. They really wanted to steer contract negotiations towards variable pricing for songs, subscription service for iTunes, much like Napster has, and more bundling of tracks with digital packages. You know, U2 has the U2 iPod. They were thinking about preloading more tracks onto the iPods. They also wanted to discuss about revenue sharing and iPod sales. Just like I believe it's Warner that gets a small cut of the profits from every single Microsoft Zune sold, a lot of these companies want a small part of the profits for every iPod sold. However, with all this discussion going on about DRM-free tracks, they feel now that Apple has the advantage, and that Apple's going to come to the table saying, "We're not giving you anything unless we first get DRM out of the picture." And they're not too happy about that. Record companies love DRM. Consumers hate it, but they love it because it gets them more money. Because if I can't play my newly purchased iTunes song in Linux, well, I have to go buy a CD now so I can play it in my Linux distribution. So it gets, you know, it's more money in their pocket in the end. Obviously, DRM does cut down on piracy a bit. DRM-free tracks are going to encourage piracy probably a little bit. But needless to say, they're not happy, regardless of however I say it. You know, Rob, when you look at this, do you think they actually have a legitimate beef going on? Or when you see things as variable pricing for songs, do you think, thank God for EMI putting Apple in the advantage point, because I don't want things like this?
Well, I think we can both agree that if the music industry had its way, then we wouldn't have the iTunes store as we currently do. Now, we spoke a little bit about variable pricing before, and it's something that the music industry currently does with CDs. Basically, it's charging more for the popular artists. And it's an excellent way of getting more money, because naturally, if something is going to be bought by more people, then by upping the price, the profit goes up. Now, Apple is in a very unique position, because they own this market. They have the digital download market wrapped up, and they can pretty much ask what they want. Now, there's obviously very careful consideration put in between with the negotiations between the companies, but they can very much push forward the ideals that they know have worked. And we've shown before that they've got this huge infrastructure which they've invested heavily in, and it's something which has worked very well. So naturally, the industry is watching what EMI do, because if this whole thing of DRM-free becomes a success, then it's something that everyone else is going to be trying to do, because naturally they want to increase their profits and they want to increase their market share. Now, the whole concept of piracy with it, well, obviously, if you don't have digital rights management, then the concerns of piracy are an issue. But I think what EMI are hoping for, which we discussed last week, is that the increase in sales, which will result from not having DRM, will be offset the initial concerns with piracy. And that's something which I hope will happen, obviously, because DRM-free is right for consumers. It's perfect for us. I think I'm not the only one that doesn't purchase online music because I hate the restrictions placed upon me. I physically just refuse to do it. That said, if this changes, and it does change in May, I will be buying more stuff online because we've both upped the quality and we've removed the digital rights management restrictions. So I think it's a wonderful move. It's just very much like everyone is watching to see what happens.
Yeah, a lot of it too is going, I mean, EMI, they made a statement in stripping DRM out of their music. However, in the news.com article, they say that most of these three guys, especially Warner and Sony BMG, are going to be watching Universal, because Universal right now currently has the largest stake in market share in the industry, about 30%. And they're going to see what Universal does. If Universal goes ahead and says, okay, we're going to strip DRM out, then they really have no choice if they want to compete. A few industry analysts also feel that it's going to be about 2 months right now while these companies watch EMI sales, especially in the digital media market. They're going to see, do their sales increase? Do they gain market share on the other guys? You know, if their market share goes up, then there's no doubt about it. It's working. You have to strip DRM out if you want to, you know, get the public's attention and really get sales moving forward to a point where you can make more money. Let's face it, these guys love their money just like the next person. That said, it's definitely up to EMI, because if EMI fails miserably at this, if their sales don't go up at all, if maybe they even go down because of the higher price related to the DRM-free tracks, then maybe these record labels are going to go to Apple and say, well, what's our incentive to strip DRM out? EMI's not doing so hot. What the heck should we worry about it for? So I hate putting it on EMI's shoulders, but it's really on their shoulders right now to sway the opinions of those in charge at these major labels. One thing that interests me though is the fact that they want a subscription platform from iTunes. I've never been fond of these subscription platforms, whether it's I know I think Microsoft had one for a while. I'm not even sure though, but I definitely know Real Networks has one in their Rhapsody service. Napster has one going on. There's a lot of subscription services out there. I believe the number two online music service behind iTunes is actually eMusic, which is purely subscription based. They actually just signed up their 300,000 subscriber this month. So obviously, these record companies like the idea of people paying monthly for access to their entire catalog, and then you pay extra if you want to burn the tracks, the CD and such. But it's definitely interesting when they start talking about variable pricing as far as the tracks go, because I don't want to pay $2 for a new single just because it's a lot of other people like it. So a track's going to cost less if I'm one of the few people who actually like it. What the heck is that? It shouldn't be based on that. I like Apple's approach of one cost, every track has the same amount of value to it, regardless of how popular it is. Everyone's going to be looking at you, EMI, so make sure you get some sales going. Promote the hell out of your stuff, and let's hope you do us all a favor and succeed, because I'm tired of DRM, Rob is tired of DRM, everyone's tired of DRM. Let's get rid of DRM. That said though, it's the end of the show, ladies and gentlemen. Well, the discussion points at least. We're going to start off with a new idea for the show, suggested by our own administrator, Neobond, Stephen Parker. That's Thread of the Week. Rob, I'll take the privilege this week. I guess you can introduce it next week. This is actually a thread. It's in the general discussion forums on neowin.net, so you can check it out there. And the title of the thread is When Threads Collide. The idea of the thread is that in every forum index, there's a whole bunch of titles posted. You know, help me out in XP. Things are broken here. Yada. You know, a whole bunch of titles. And sometimes when you read them together, it's actually pretty humorous, the result. And one of the more recent posts has a screenshot. I'm pulling it up now, one second. And it says, these are two separate threads, but putting them together, just, it's hysterical. Family relations, an unforgettable dream? You know, things like that. You have to read it. I'm probably butchering it. But it's definitely some pretty funny stuff in this thread. It's gone on, it's about 30 pages now, so it's a lot of content to read through. You know, if you ever get some time, you want a good chuckle, you maybe want to contribute a little yourself, get that post count up. It's definitely a thread to check out. So that's When Threads Collide in the general discussion forum. We'll also be linking to it from the news post for this show. Now, Rob, I know you were sweating this pre-show, but I hope you have something in your head right now. It's your time for Code of the Week.
Excellent. Well, my code of the week, I guess, is just a statement, and that's really to say that Internet Explorer 6 is not dead, however much I think we'd all wish that it is. Ultimately, we still have a huge market share on a very poor browser, and even though Internet Explorer 7 is doing a huge amount to help that, it's still not going to be in businesses for a long time yet. That's just because migration takes a long time. So I think it's incredibly foolish for people to say that, well, I don't like the browser, so I'm not going to work with it. Ultimately, you have to, because Internet Explorer 6 is a major platform, and it's something you really do need to think about. So I guess my tip is just don't be so quick to judge that one, because even though we all know it's not very good, it still has to work. I will say quickly, while I'm on the kind of development front, that Dave and I added a feature last week called Add to Facebook. Now, if you're anything like me, Facebook has pretty much taken over your life. It's a wonderful social networking site. It's basically, you know, think MySpace, but without all the garish rubbish. It's really nice and clean, and it does it really well, especially when it comes into like looking with your university friends and the like. Anyway, we to promote Neowin, let's say, with each podcast, you can now click an Add to Facebook link, and it will put it directly on your wall, and you can see, and people can stream the music straight from your profile, which is a really neat way of doing things. So if you fancy supporting the site, give that one a go. And yeah, so I guess that's my code of the week for this time.
All right, well, I'm actually going to cheat a little this week. I'm not going to do song of the week. I'm actually going to do movie of the week, because yesterday I saw a movie that, well, it's probably become my new favorite movie. So, name of the movie is V for Vendetta. It's done by the Wachowski brothers, the same guys who did the Matrix trilogy. It stars Hugo Weaving as the main character, V. You know him as Agent Smith. And Natalie Portman as the female co-star, Evie. And it's really an amazing movie. I could sit here talking about it for hours, but it's all about standing up to an over-tyrannical government, if that's the proper word, and really fighting for the freedom of fellow men, not just yourself. It's an absolutely stunning movie. The main character, V, has this elegance and artistry to him that really captivates you as a viewer. And, I mean, it's over 2 hours long, but I couldn't turn my head away. It's one of the it's definitely the best movie I've ever seen. I'm a guy who likes cheap action flicks, Will Ferrell comedies. You know, I'm not one of these guys who goes for the deep movies, but I absolutely love V for Vendetta, and I recommend any of you out there with a DVD player that plays, you know, movies, so don't buy a Sony one, you know, rent it, buy it, I don't know. I'm pretty sure Amazon Unbox service might even have it, so you can even download it legally. But get this movie, spend 2 hours, watch it, and I guarantee you'll walk away thinking, wow, that was pretty cool. Don't expect a cheap action flick. You know, if you're looking for just cheap action, this is not the movie for you. But if you're looking for something a little deeper, something a little artistic, a little flamboyant, this is definitely the movie for you. That's V for Vendetta, and you can find it almost anywhere. And with that, Rob, I think we're done. We've actually started preliminary talks on really improving things. We're working on improving the RSS feed, finally getting the show up and working in iTunes so you don't have to keep downloading it from the site directly. You can just have iTunes update your podcast feed for you. And hopefully all these changes will be occurring in maybe 2-3 weeks as everything gets programmed for us. There's going to be some changes to the Neowin front end to accommodate the podcast, you know, and we're really moving up there. Neobond and Dave Legg have come on to really support Rob and his programming. I'm just a talking head here. They do all the background work. But it's definitely going to be fun for all of us. You know, the show is here to stay. This is our second week in a row, Rob. I think we're setting a new record here. And, you know, thanks, guys. Thanks for all the support. We really appreciate it. Thank you to Neobond and Dave Legg for helping us out. And, well, unless, Rob, you have anything else to contribute, ladies and gentlemen, just so you know, go Yankees, Red Sox suck, have a good one.